5 contacts involved gas and electric services, 6 contacts involved cellular phone service, 6 contacts were related to the Do Not Call registry, and 10 contacts involved miscellaneous items not regulated by this PUC. 488 of the 604 complaints received thus far have been resolved, and 2,071 from 2,370 contacts received in 2004 have been resolved.
Thank you very much, Jim. We will next get to CT05-005. Before we do that, I was only half facetiously saying that Dusty might be feeling a little bit faint. Perhaps he is. Congratulations, Dusty, on your newborn, on Maxwell. We hope that you're getting some sleep still.
I'm doing all right, better than I would have expected.
Well, congrats.
Thank you very much.
On CT05-005, in the matter of the complaints filed by customers of SNS Communications, we have 3 questions before us. Shall the Commission grant staff's motion to consolidate? Shall the Commission order that any subsequently filed complaints against SNS involving the same subject matter be consolidated into this docket? Shall the Commission order such other relief as requested in the motion to consolidate? Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff filed this motion for the purpose of, implementing a practicably workable procedure for dealing with the 145 SNS complaints that we currently have pending. And as the Commission directed a couple months ago, we will be doing one last mailing out to all known customers of SNS, and it's possible that we may wind up having an additional complaint or two filed as a result of that. Our reason, more than anything else, I think, for wanting to consolidate these is we just think it's going to both lead to a more practical and also, I think, a more fair process for dealing with these complaints. If we deal with them each on an individual basis, there's significant risk, I think, in our view, that we could end up with disparate treatment of the various complaints. And in the interest of having a unified and fair approach for everyone, and also another factor that may or may not be known to the Commission, but the statute that allows for enforcement of complaints, damage awards in the circuit court, only allows joinder of parties in those cases to the extent that those cases have been consolidated at the Commission level. And so to avoid having to have 145 or 150 separate actions to obtain civil judgments, assuming that the Commission issues damage awards in these cases, to me it makes good sense to consolidate now. There are, I think as the Commission recalls from the proceedings in TC02166, all of this stems from some 650 prepaid services contracts that SNS entered into in South Dakota. As the Commission recalls from that case, on or about June 3rd of 2003, SNS, in fact, ceased providing services. And many, many, many of those 650 customers at that point lost service for which they had already paid. I think that's a fact. That particular set of facts is common to all these complaints. The issues of law are largely common to all these complaints. There will be little differences between the different complainants, but I think this well fits within the standards for consolidation of a case. And therefore, we would request that all of these currently pending cases be consolidated into one proceeding. Although I didn't expressly state it in the motion because they don't exist yet, I would also like the Commission to move and to direct the staff to consolidate any additional complaint filings that revolve around the same general set of facts into this proceeding. I'm going to, I guess, verbally so move at this point in time. And lastly, I would like the commission to order that the individual complaint dockets then be deemed closed and integrated into the consolidated case, but that we retain each of those existing files as subfiles within this particular case simply for administrative convenience so that we can keep all the various data that relates to individual complainants in an orderly fashion. And with, I have one question I wanted to direct to Keith Sanger, who's working with me on this. And it's my understanding, Keith, that none of the complainants have contacted the commission to object to consolidation of these proceedings. Is that the case?
That is correct. There was a letter sent to all of the complaints that we have. We got 7 or 8 returned for the wrong address. The staff downstairs was great about finding addresses. We sent all those letters back. None of the ones that were sent the second time were returned. I was able to verbally contact by telephone 5 of the 7 or 8. The other 2 or 3, we could not find a telephone number for. They moved out of state, maybe don't have a landline. So I have contacted all of them, and no one has objected.
The original notice was sent on the 15th of April.
Okay.
The follow-up letters, again, Commissioner Johnson, since these complaints were filed, in 2003, and as you well know, with any group of 145 people, you're going to have people move. Some of these are business complainants, and in fact, not all businesses even last that long. And so we've had various situations where we've had address changes. We've literally had several of these complainants have moved out of state. But I think the staff's done a good job of tracking down people. And, you know, with both the mail notice and with the public notice of the proceeding, I'm confident that we've done all we can under the notice rules of South Dakota to provide notice to these people.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions by the commissioners?
Maybe as much a comment as anything else. And I just want to say, as someone who's gone through this process along with staff, I want to thank them for being diligent and for doing everything they can to contact the customers. And I think it's critical to try to keep the lines of communications open. So I appreciate the effort sending out the letters, sending out additional letters, and looking into that. It does sound like something that's going to be appropriate because it's going to hopefully make it easier for the consumers out there and try to get people before the commission and deal with this as easily as or the best we possibly can. And, you know, John, just because this is something where people might be listening in, do you just want to quickly explain that, you know, we've got the contract claims and the bond claims, and I know that's perhaps to most of the people in the room, that's old news. But in case people are listening in, and because this is going to be archived, just a minute or so on that, just so that if anyone does check this because they saw it on the agenda, as a consumer, they'll be able to figure that out.
And we did include in our notice, we did include a specific reference to the web broadcast of this so that people, rather than having to call in, could access it via the Internet. I obviously don't know if any of them are listening in, but hopefully they are. We have 2 proceedings pending. We will, assuming this motion to consolidate is granted. One will be the proceeding involving the complaints. Under our statutes, 49-13, persons in South Dakota have a right to file a complaint against a telecommunications company. That right isn't limited to solely customers, but in this case, all of these complaints are customers. We initially had some complaints that weren't customers. We had some complaints that involved securities-based claims and other things like that. Those complaints have been dismissed as of this point in time. I'm confident that we've given adequate notice now of this motion to all the complainants. I guess one other observation on that is if it comes to light that because of the problems, again, with maintaining addresses over lengthy periods of time, if it turns out that a complainant did not receive the written notice and at a later date wishes to carve his complaint out into a separate proceeding, I think we can deal with that at that time. In terms of the complaint cases, we're basically treating them, although they were of varying degrees of specificity in terms of prayers for relief and all that, we're basically treating all of those complaint cases as damage claims. And again, I think our purpose in wanting to consolidate those is, as I think you know from the evidence that in the 166 proceeding, the pattern here is pretty standard. You know, it's pretty much the same set of facts with different dollar amounts, different contract terms, but pretty much a standard operating procedure that S&S Communications followed in signing up customers and in the way they went about doing their business. So that's what this proceeding is about, will be to pursue these damage claims through to completion. And at such time as the commission issues a damages award in the case, and I'm assuming we would issue one joint consolidated damages award, at that point in time, I'm hopeful that the commission would issue an order also setting a time limit for payment of that. And the Section 4913, Chapter 4913, then allows complainants to then go to circuit court if that damage award isn't satisfied within the time limit that you set. At such time, the record that you make in this complaint proceeding will be admissible as the record in the circuit court case. And assuming that we prevail, at some point in time, all of these damage awards that you issue, or the consolidated damages award, will be enterable as a judgment in the circuit court system and will then become a potential long-term lien on the assets of the principals of SMS. That's the way I see this potentially coming down. The other aspect of this whole thing is the proceeding involving the bond proceeds. And it's not that's related to this case. And in fact, if you recall, one of the points of relief we asked for in the bond case was that both that complaints filed in this proceeding be treated as claims against the bond. We also have some other persons who have elected not to file formal damages claims, but have nevertheless filed claims against the bond. And so there will be a slightly different track with respect to those two cases, but they will be similar. And the way I see that working is that when you finally ultimately determine the damage awards in this case, that those damages awards may, with some exceptions, pretty much be the same as the amount of that you're going to authorize as claims against the bond. There may be a few exceptions because we do have a few cases that we've discovered where people were definitely damaged, but for whatever reason, their claims were forgiven for this or that reason by a lender. We've had some credit card companies who, because of their warranty provisions in their credit card terms, have forgiven the debts. And again, we'll cross those bridges when we come to them. I don't think we're there yet. And we have several cases where lenders such as Carroll Credit, Midland Leasing in Aberdeen, and Aberdeen Finance Corporation advance loans to pay for prepaid services, and those loans have been forgiven. And again, we'll deal with that issue when we get to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. Is there anyone else either in the room or telephonically who
wishes to make any statement pertaining to this item?
I just had one other question.
Thank you.
And that would be then, Going with respect to your last statement, John, would you anticipate that the commission would move forward with this docket before moving forward with the bond proceed docket then? Is that?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Roland. Is there a motion on CT-05-005?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we grant staff's motion to consolidate and also that any subsequently filed complaint against SNS involving the same subject matter be consolidated into this docket and that we order the other relief as requested in the motion to consolidate.
Chairman, I second.
And I concur. Motion carries. Under item EL-05-006, in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy for approval of tariff revisions. Question is, shall the commission approve the tariff revisions? I have a, I think I'll open it up for any discussion from the commissioners at this juncture.
Mr. Chairman, I had heard speculation that there might be additional information from the petitioner. Is that true? Or?
This is Alan Dietrich from Northwestern. I am on the line. Sorry, I wasn't able to be there in person. I believe Warren Lothberg and Jeff Decker are there in person. And we also asked Kyle White of Black Hills Power and Light to join the meeting. And I believe Kyle was on telephonically. One of the questions that had arisen at the last time this was before the commission dealt with some of the legislative history behind SBCL 4934A 8.3, and I guess, Bob Miller from the South Dakota Electric Utility Companies had attempted to address that question. I believe it was indicated that Mr. White might be able to provide some additional information, and perhaps Mr. Lothberg can as well. It of course is Northwestern's position that the tariff that we're seeking to have changes that we're seeking to have approved are in the public interest under that statute because they are consistent with the interest not only of customers for whom we'd be offering this rate, but also our customers as a whole. And I guess that Mr. Lothberg or Mr. White have anything to add as to the enactment of that statute and how it interfaces with the Black Hills tariff that was in place at the time that legislation was passed. I think that might be helpful to the commission as they consider whether to approve the tariff.
Mr. White, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
All right. You're not coming through real strong. Could you speak up a little bit louder?
Okay. Is this better?
That's much better. Is there anything that you wish to inform the commission of this morning?
Well, as I understand it, the question came up as to Black Hills Power's business development service tariff. In August 1995, that tariff really allows Black Hills Power to enter into contracts with customers that have the same requirements.
Mr. White, excuse me, I'm going to ask you to slow down and speak up a little bit more. We are transcribing this and having a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
Okay. I apologize for that. About 6 inches. Black Hills Power in 1995 recognized that it would have need to work with customers that had cheap or competitive alternatives for their electric service. And we designed what we call our business development service tariff. That tariff outlines certain criteria where customers can work with the company to negotiate contracts that are specific to their needs. One of the opportunities a customer has is that if they have competitive alternatives to taking power under one of our standard tariffs, we then would negotiate a contract with deviation. And one of the criteria within this tariff is basically if the
Thank you very much, Mr. White. Mr. Lossberg, did you have something to add?
Warren Lossberg, Governmental Relations, Northwestern Huron. I think Kyle's got it about right. As I recall, the legislation, there was...
Mic on.
I'm sorry. There was some question as to whether or not specifically that activity would be allowed under South Dakota law, and we passed the legislation to make sure that that detail of that particular activity was within the bounds of authority. Kind of a look-back fix.
Thank you. And is there anyone else that you have that would like to testify on this today?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that's all we have in follow-up to the discussion that we had at the previous meeting. Northwestern would urge the Commission to approve the tariff subject to those changes which we've discussed with staff as to language in the tariff, and I think we've pretty much reconciled those with Mr. Jacobson as to how we would provide those changes in final tariff.
Well, I have some concern regarding this, and Bob Miller was stepping up to the mic just as you began to speak, and I noticed that he has the South Dakota codified laws with him, and perhaps he was going to answer my question for me before I asked it. So, Bob, would you like to tell us what you have to say?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Miller, I'm not sure what your question is going to be, but historically, I was involved in the passage of this legislation, and I was the lobbyist who handled this legislation, and I can tell you what the intent of the companies who sought this legislation, and as we explained it to the legislature. Now, I understand our rule in South Dakota about legislative intent, but we asked for and thought we received exactly as you've heard it described by both Alan and Kyle White, that this was this parameter, and we came back to you after the fact. And that was what we believe we asked the legislature and what we believe the legislature agreed to permit. Thank you.
Are there any questions by the commissioners?
Yes, Chairman. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Thank you, Dusty. Further questions by the commission?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested to hear if staff have any additional analysis or comments, or if they have any response to what Bob and Kyle and Alan brought forth.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, I would as well. Dave.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, at this point, I really was not involved with the creation of the legislation, so it's hard for me to give a opinion as to the intent of it. I think, and with my counsel here on staff, we've just literally read the statute as it exists, and it contains the words approval and approved in there. Yeah, that's why we brought it to the commission's attention, so that you know, a determination could be made on that point. Other than that, you know, we did pursue some additional questions against Northwestern about the contact that they discussed at the last meeting, and I believe you do have those responses. We would just say that if the commission did choose to approve this filing, that we would like to mention the conditions and language changes that Alan spoke of on the phone, and some of those probably would be appropriate to put those in the order, in commission's order.
Thank you, Dave. And you bring up a good point. The legislation, as I understand it, basically gives permission so that if the PUC wanted to allow this, they could, as opposed to saying that the commission shall do this. And at the same time, there's a question of precedence of if some companies are allowed to do this, should not all companies be allowed to do this? Do you have anything to say to that?
I have spoken to other companies since the last meeting about other matters, and they have brought up, and I believe some of them are listening on the Internet if they're not on the phone. And there's already been an intent expressed that they will probably pursue the same type of arrangement, same type of filing. So.
Thank you, Dave. Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, if staff's finished, I have a few questions for Mr. Dietrich.
Please.
Mr. Dietrich, do you know, is there any case of this being utilized since the statute was put into place in the 1990s?
I guess this statute having been used since it's been enacted by, in terms of a new tariff,
yeah.
I am not aware of that.
And
I'm not certain if the Mid-American Gas Tariff, Economic Development Service Tariff, was done in response to that or not, but I'm not aware of anything else.
Okay, so right now it appears to be something that was, so to speak, utilized after the fact to make sure that previous approved tariff or commission order, or however it was done, or maybe it was a practice, I can't remember, would
pass. Yeah, there was a Black Hills tariff. Of course, Northwestern has had some business development tariffs in effect for some period of time. Prior to the Black Hills tariff, even as well.
Okay, so it does look like it was something, though, that was done after the fact and probably, as far as we can tell, hasn't been utilized since.
That very well may be the case. I'm not as familiar with all the other companies' tariffs, but I don't believe we have specifically proposed anything under it.
And if we're kind of weighing the issue of precedence, would it be fair to say that most of the other companies and I don't know your practices, but most of the companies are using contracts with deviations to address these type of issues?
We have not had a contract with deviations proposed on the electric side of our business. I'm not certain. I know Otter Tail has had contracts with deviations, whether they're business development or other new customer or existing customer. I'm not certain. I'm not aware of what the other companies are doing, I guess.
And have you had any further discussions with staff about some type of expedited, and I don't even know if it'd be expedited's the right word, because it sounds like from staff's indication at the last meeting that there would be the possibility to move relatively quickly on a contract for deviations. And I mean, if someone calls you up and says, I need a bid by 5 o'clock and it's 9 in the morning, that might be too fast. But I think most of these deals, you have a longer period of time. Have you had additional conversations with staff about that?
Yes, We have not talked to staff about that since the 26th of April. I do believe that the process that Mr. White discussed for Black Hill sounds like a reasonable approach, but in those circumstances where it is workable and negotiating with the customer to present it to the commission for approval, that we'd be willing to do that. The difficult situation that we find is in those customers that are seeking a competitive electric bid and may not be willing to treat a conditional offer by us in the same fashion that they treat a firm offer from another supplier. But in the case, if this tariff were approved, I think we would be comfortable indicating we would take the same approach as Black Hills, and that would be to where it is workable with the customer to present this, and the time frame is appropriate, we would present it to the commission.
Well, and I'm going to ask a question that I think I asked at the last meeting to Mr. Jacobson, but how quickly do you think you can move on an expedited request?
Oh, from staff's point of view, again, it depends on the information supplied by the company at the time of the request. We've handled these in less than a week's time before. It was obvious from the company that they said they needed to make firm commitments within a period of a couple hours, which obviously would give us no time to review anything.
Well, I'm thinking back to the hearing we had on the turkey growers, and it seemed to me in that case, I realized there were some last-minute runs out to the golf course or whatever it was, but it seems to me that was a rather lengthy negotiation process, and we can obviously notice a matter for hearing with 48 hours notice. I could potentially, like you said, see some process that would be less than a week. I mean, Mr. Dietrich, in most situations, wouldn't that give you adequate time you're going to have to put together a bid, you're going to have to do this, you're going to do that. Doesn't that give you, aren't you having a little more lead time than just your typical Supercenter X is calling you up at 9 a.m. and saying they want something at 5 o'clock?
In most cases, we're going to have a certain period of time. In the case of the Dakota turkey growers, we were given about a two-day period. We've been just negotiating with them, giving them offers and talking to them, and then they came back and said, we want an answer and we want it within a kind of a quick time period, and that's when we kind of had the mad rush to get the information to Mr. Rutledge. But the difficulty that I see in this process is the fact that the customers may not be willing to enter into a conditional agreement for us to bring you. It's kind of, as I said before, kind of a chicken and egg situation where if you can't get the customer's name on the dotted line because he's offered another contract in a firm basis, we don't have anything to bring you, get your approval for if we can't reach the deal with the customer. And it puts us in the awkward position of trying to get we have another utility that can give them a firm price. We cannot. And the difficulty we have is in getting something to bring to you for the expedited acceptance and approval. If we can't get there, we're going to continue to be the one who's intervening and trying to establish that, that we should be the electric provider. So I guess I have all respect for staff and their willingness to work with us to bring matters before the commission in an expedited fashion. It's just we may not get to the point of being able to bring them to them.
Commissioner Saar?
Yes.
Kyle White again. Could I add something?
Please.
What I'd like to share is that this isn't always competition by adjoining utilities. When we developed our tariff, the thought was we would be competing with utilities in other states to try and attract businesses to South Dakota. And it is important when you're making your proposal that's included in a community economic development package that as the utility
Commissioner Johnson.
Yes, Commissioner Starr, were you done?
No, but I'll let Commissioner Johnson go ahead.
Go ahead, Commissioner Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate that. I've got a question, you know, first for Mr. Diedrich and then for staff. Mr. Diedrich, would some sort of pre-approval by the commission fit your needs? And then I guess my question for Mr. Rizalov or Mr. Smith or anybody else, would the commission have the power to pre-approve a contract with you?
This is Greg Rislov.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I guess I would maintain the commission would have the power to pre-approve. Basically, what we're talking about are fuel cost and then a margin above fuel cost. And so it's not a difficult thing to approve a floor at fuel cost and I suppose an increment above that, although that doesn't even have to be solid, and that's been proven in the past. I think it's interesting to note that the provision we're talking about has never been used, and yet everyone has been doing business since that time. But truthfully, I guess another way to look at it is if the utility wants to go ahead and get a tariff like this, the commission staff will have much more time to consider what the appropriate margin will be later on during the rate case. Whatever that may be, that now that may be above what they're actually getting.
Commissioner Johnson, does that answer your question, or do you want some further?
Well, it answers my question on the authority side, I guess, from the industry side. Mr. Diedrich, would pre-approval by the commission of a contract you tender as a bid, would that address your needs?
Well, I guess I'm not certain what you're asking. If you're asking for us to come forward and say, we want the authority to offer, you know, the following or the following range, we want the authority to offer a specific dollar amount, you know, then we go and negotiate. We may, in an iterative process, have to come back again anyway. If we're saying that we want the authority to offer customers rates above our cost, essentially, I think that's what we're doing in this tariff. We're saying we would look at the cost to serve this customer, and we would not offer him a rate which is above our tariff rate or below what the incremental costs are to serve him. And, you know, I think that's what we're doing already.
I certainly understand, and I'll actually hold my comments to my other questions. I did butt in on Commissioner Starr. My apologies.
You asked my next questions anyway, so thank you.
Are you done then? Or did you have some?
I'll throw this out to you, Mr. Diedrich. One of the things I'm looking at here is, I think it was, you know, obviously a completely appropriate option for you to file as you did. But one of the things about you filing under your own particular tariff provisions is it may exclude interveners who have interest in this matter. We're certainly seeing a high level of interest from the investor-owned companies. We have Black Hills Power coming in with some friendly comments. We have the head of the group of the IOUs appearing and giving input into this. I guess questions or concerns would be, are we better off opening this up to a process where perhaps more people could have public input into this and be able to allow people in who wouldn't normally be a party? Because obviously in the tariff provisions, you might be able to exclude anyone or somebody might decide not to file because they're not a rate payer. So there may be some questions of standing. Are we better off opening up this process and trying to figure this out, especially since, I mean, clearly – I don't know if I completely buy into the Black Hills Power idea of being this great precedence. I think it's something that's maybe instructive and illustrative, but it sounds to me like it's kind of an after-the-fact statute that was there to ratify a practice which was already going on and maybe for some, I guess, kind of hard-nosed negotiations at the time. This, I think, decision likely, though, it is going to be something where if we grant this to Northwestern, you know, there certainly are going to be challenges to turn around and turning it down for the next IOU that comes in and asks for it. You know, so right now we have Northwestern coming in, but we don't have input from really from other IOUs. We don't have input from some of the other people in the industry. No opportunity for consumers unless you happen to be a Northwestern ratepayer to get involved. Do you think, Alan, it might be appropriate for the commission to kind of take a step back, and certainly we could look at opening up some type of broader docket or ask for some sort of public comments beyond just what might normally be appropriate or legally permissible under the way that it's been filed now?
Well, we certainly would have no problem with input from other interested parties. Certainly other investor owns, if they have in fact been contacting Mr. Jacobson and indicating that, you know, that they think this is an important item and they would like to have or consider similar tariff provisions, you know, I certainly have no problem with other affected utilities. You know, needless to say, we have competitors, and competitors may or may not be interested in us having this as a tool to compete with them. You know, it would be helpful if we could appear before their boards and argue tariffs that they might be offering as well. But we certainly have no problem with providing a broader method of input into such matters. But at the same time, you know, we have real-life situations where we think we would utilize this tariff. So, you know, we certainly are interested in having it approved and moving forward to consider negotiations under it. But, you know, I think that's up to the commission to determine what's in its best, the best interest of the people of South Dakota as to whether to broaden the input on this matter.
Well, and just to clarify something, Mr. Dietrich, I wasn't suggesting that they should be able to come into Northwestern's boardroom or management offices when you're discussing this. I mean, this is a major public policy decision, and it's very, to me, it's almost legislative in nature. Part of me is kind of saying maybe you guys should take it back to the legislature if you want to make sure. I mean, we ratify this after the fact, make sure they want it going forward. So, I mean, part of me thinks almost just take a pass on this, so to speak. But I think the ability to get it, I don't even know if any of these people are going to intervene. I mean, it might just be Northwestern again, but at the very least, then we can feel like we got adequate public input, because I think you have a hard time making an argument that standing goes beyond probably just a ratepayer of Northwestern. And maybe I'm wrong on that. That's from suggestions from counsel, but I think it is a pretty broad policy decision. And again, I think once the genie's out of the bottle, it's going to be difficult to go back and say, okay, Otter Tail, you can't do this. Northwestern, you can. Excel, you don't want to do it. Black Hills, you like doing it, and so on and so forth. And certainly nobody wants to do anything that's going to harm Northwestern's ability to compete, but we're probably talking about a matter of a few weeks or a couple months at tops if we can open up the process to more public input. And if people don't come in and give any public input, I mean, if it's silent, I think that probably speaks on Northwestern's behalf that maybe it's not as controversial as we might think it is. Or you never know. Maybe someone's going to come in and say, we like Northwestern's plan. It'll give us the ability to attract more businesses, which I think, in whole, we all would like to see that, as long as it doesn't happen at the expense of the ratepayers.
Well, I guess because Northwestern would be the one who would potentially object to someone else providing public information at a future meeting with regard to this docket, if we left this open, we certainly could recommend that if we could put this perhaps on the commission's next agenda, which is, I guess, a meeting 2 weeks out, or if you wanted to provide more time for public input, set it at the meeting after that and then allow the interested parties to come forward. This time I have no objection to that type of an approach. And we would not object to that input, certainly not from other regulated utilities who might have pros and cons to present with regard to this approach. And certainly if they're considering it, it may give the commission an opportunity to have their input before it decides on the first application.
Commissioner Hansen, could I take another stab at addressing Commissioner Johnson's question? This is Greg Risler.
Please, Greg.
I perhaps wasn't as clear as I should have been. The tariff I was discussing would talk about recovery of fuel and variable cost of serving that customer. Now, we do have tariffs that look a lot like that, and essentially what that means is the utility is going to recover its fuel cost. And if you continue reading on, most of those tariffs will say that there's not a firm or hard and fast floor on the recovery of other costs. And the reason why, and if I could go back into history, and I'll try not to go back 29 years, is that when we talk about Black Hills and Otter Tail and Mid-American, and for that matter, XL and Northwestern, we've always trusted these utilities to do what was in the best interest of their customers. We understood that they had such few opportunity to actually pull in a big load, and we knew that big load could help the residential customers. On the other hand, we were concerned that if we didn't approve these tariffs, I'm not going to come in with all the potential problems of not approving tariffs. I mean, there could be some risk for the utility coming in the next rate case. There'd be risk for the commissioners. There's no public hearing. We get into all those issues. But frankly, once we approve that tariff that says basically fuel cost plus, please, gentlemen, use your best judgment on the margin above that, to me, that is a filed tariff. They can go out and negotiate, and they can come in after the negotiation's done and show us that that does meet with that tariff. So essentially that, to me, is not only all the freedom the utility would want, they're recovering the costs they need to recover that they don't want to actually charge less than, fuel cost, but it's solid. There's no challenge to it after that point. No one's going to come in and say, well, this rate was too low because it conforms to the commission's tariff. We gave them our blessing. Now, I suppose if we had 10 of these tariffs filed over the years and they were clearly confiscatory, there would be a problem. But frankly, I think especially in the case of Black Hills Power, they seem to have such an inordinate number of very large customers in a small service territory. And I think they've done just an excellent job following these type of guidelines over the last 20 years or so. But that was my point, that you basically establish a baseline and a public interest test on a margin. The utility comes in and shows that they're trying to meet that public interest test, that there is contribution for the other customers. And honestly, I don't recall ever rejecting one of those when, and I'll name the utility, when Black Hills comes with that kind of a filing. Now, was that pursuant to the tariff that that Mr. Dietrich has referred to? Not really. I don't know if, I won't even get into history of that tariff. That was kind of an odd duck from my point of view, but it's a contract with deviations type of thing, or it's a filed tariff that specifies that floor. I just think there's a lot of freedom with that, and it covers the risk, I think, for all parties if it's done in that manner. But that's, I apologize for being so long. That's just kind of my view on this. I don't know if that helped or not.
Thank you, Greg. Commissioner Johnson, do you have any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Dietrich, how long has it been since Northwestern's last rate case on the electric side?
I believe the Northwestern's last electric rate case was in the mid-1980s.
Mr. Dietrich, you sort of, because you were kind of asking the question when I was asking about pre-approval, it sort of seemed like you were saying, well, what's the difference between pre-approval or essentially having the formula that the commission could then review at the next rate case. I guess my concern, I haven't been through rate case, so part of my concern may be, certainly be from inexperience, but it seems I'm somewhat uncomfortable, not completely, but somewhat uncomfortable with saying that it might be 15 years down the road before the commission would have any authority to be able to really review and have any impact on contract negotiations. Do you have anything, are my concerns well placed, or do you have anything that may allay those concerns?
Well, I think, we've presented to staff in this docket a proposed analysis that we undertake before we would make the the determination of what we're willing to offer the customer. And in making that determination, you know, we are coming to a conclusion that our costs to provide the customer are covered and that there's some margin for the other customers. If we don't file a rate case for, let's say, 10 years, I don't think that's likely, but if we don't file a rate case for 10 years, if we have a revenue shortfall from that serving that customer, the company absorbs that shortfall. We're not asking the other customers to make it up. In fact, our existing tariff one of the tariffs that we're adding that specifically says that in no way should other customers suffer a detriment or a cost because of our service to this customer. So, you know, what you'd be determining in the rate case is the company's overall revenue requirement, and in the test period, during that test period, did in fact the company, should the company have collected more from this customer? In other words, would the commission impute some level of revenue above what the company actually received in determining the company's overall revenue requirement? And for all periods prior to that test period, if the company should have collected more, the company's at risk. During the test period, the company has the burden of proof. The company does not meet that burden of proof, but the commission could impute additional revenues, thereby providing less additional revenue that the company would need to gain in the rate increase filing if, you know, if that were, in fact, the conclusion. So I'm not sure that I've answered your question adequately, but I believe under the mechanism that we've established in this proposed tariff, other customers are not at risk to receive any negative impacts from the offering of a contract and pursuant to this new tariff.
If some sort of a pre-approval mechanism was in place, which might not be quite as fast as no upfront commission approval, but would instead give Northwestern assurances that shareholders would not, you know, that there wouldn't be that difference
Well, I guess I go back to what I said earlier. By pre-approval, are you saying that we would come in and say we want to offer a 3.5 cent rate to this customer, and then the commission would say, you know, we will approve that, you are making that offer, and then we go to the customer and the customer says, you know, 3.5 cents. Isn't going to be competitive. I can get 3.3 cents from your competitor. Or in the case that Kyle White indicated, you know, our overall benefit package, including electric rates in a difference in the state of Minnesota, is better. You know, whatever the alternative is, the thing that this tariff is specifically looking to are Section 56 competitive supplier question. If we're talking about a broader concept like Mr. Rizloff was describing, where the company, if the company approves it, covers its cost, it is allowed to serve, you know, I think that's what I'm asking for in the tariff that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Neighbor. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Dave, not quite certain who to start with here. Are there any other companies that have this option besides Black Hills that you're aware of in South Dakota?
Well, there are flexible rates available. Most of them specify a floor. I'm not aware of anything like Black Hills that's that to really, you know, goes without approval, those same parameters that are in there. No, I don't. I'm not absolutely positive, but I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. White, did you say how many times you have exercised this?
Well, we have made numerous proposals as part of the Economic Development Act. We have negotiated contracts for unique service requirements for a number of customers. We have had a practice, if the customer is willing, to file these with the commission to add a contract with deviations, but we really see them as pre-approved, and that's more of a formal process. If we had a customer that was unwilling to go that direction, file it with permission as a confidential filing and ask that it just be included in your file, our contract specification. To date, we have not had that circumstance arise. But it is important to us that when we make proposals, we have high confidence that we can live up to those. That's why we signed our tariff.
Thank you, Kyle. And yet you've stated that it's your practice or would be your practice to bring these before the PUC for approval after the presentation to the company.
Yes, that has been our practice. And it will be our practice so long as it works for the customer. But there are instances where I could foresee that we would have the contract negotiated and we would not be willing to have it be docketed because that's the customer.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, could we chat for just a second? When you presented the information pertaining to the legislation, and since you were there, not that we are to be constrained by what the legislature did or what their thoughts were, other than certainly we're constrained by to work within the parameters of the law. Does that say shall or may, in your opinion? Does that give?
Well, Mr. Chairman, 8.3 clearly says the commission may approve the parameters of these rates, the highs and the lows.
Forgive me to all of the attorneys and staff who I've asked Bob to give me legal advice here this morning. But I appreciate since
my
you have
a Republic certificate does not qualify me for that.
Since you have a have the law in front of you there, I wanted to thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm a bit I'm struggling with this. Not as much now as I was before, because I know that there are other states that have allowed this, and New York PSC just recently gave permission for it. I've struggled because of I certainly want to encourage businesses to do business in South Dakota and give opportunities for that competition. At the same time, I'm concerned with consumer protection. And could someone on staff shed some light for me in regards to what challenges there might be for consumer protection if we were to pass this?
Well, the alternative is, in these cases and in this case, that the company is not willing to change a rate upon filing of a rate case. Once the rate is offered in a contract, it's going to endure throughout the term of the contract. If the rate case is filed before the end of the term of the contract, there is, I mean, one option, and I fail to see really any other option, is that if the rate is under recovering costs that the utility is incurring, that really it's left to the shareholders to cover that cost. Is there any damage to the other customers? Well, I mean, theoretically, you could say that if a big customer came on with a perfect load factor and everything else, that if a rate case was initiated by staff, that if there's a possibility that rates could be lower. It's very hard to see that circumstance actually panning out like that, considering the length of time it's been since a lot of these companies come in. You'd almost expect that the rates probably go up in these circumstances for everybody. I think that the really the companies are is correct in that it's hard to tell unless you have absolute numbers and absolute evidence as is presented in a rate case, but they're really. The circumstance would be normally that the customer is protected until the next rate case, and at that point, the shareholder is at risk, not the other customers. The alternative would be to have a contract where the rate could change during the term upon a rate case being filed. But again, the companies all allude to the fact that they need to have a firm offer throughout the term of the contract, so they don't. To them, that's not an option. The rate has to be firm throughout the contract.
Thank you, Dave. Next question has been answered, but I still struggle with it, is, and if Mr. White or Mr. Dietrich, Mr. Lassberg could shed some light on this. I struggle with the fact that Black Hills has testified that if they go through this particular process, they would still come before the PUC for, I'm going to assume, for approval. And Mr. Dietrich has testified that they would follow the same standard operating procedure. I recognize that there's some benefit to being able to say up front, here's our offer, but wouldn't you still be required, if in fact you're bringing it to the PUC for approval, to state that you're bringing it to the PUC for approval? And isn't that exactly what we have at the present time? Notwithstanding your previous arguments, it's lost on me why that doesn't stand.
Well, Mr. Allen, if I could speak for what Mr. White has said, was where the customer is willing to allow an offer conditioned upon commission approval to go to the commission for such approval, they do so. Where the company or the potential customer wants a firm price, not a conditional price, Black Hills, even though it has not had that situation, would enter into that contract with the customer and merely file it with the commission, saying, here's a contract pursuant to our tariff that would be filed where you have filed our contracts with deviations in the past, and it is the contract that deviates from our tariff. And that's kind of paraphrasing what I understand Kyle to say, and I think Northwestern would also be. Is that correct, Mr. White?
Yes, Alan, that is correct. Realistically, what our tariff does is it provides us the flexibility to produce new loads, be creative on behalf of our customers, need creative solutions. And it isn't a methodology for us to necessarily avoid the commission at all costs. And we know the commission prefers to have these common contract deviations, and so we acknowledge that in our negotiations. But this tariff signed allow us to do the best on behalf of our electric utility company and hopefully on behalf of the state of South Dakota and track flow. So it's about flexibility of negotiating table. And we believe that's important. We have not had circumstances where we've been required to use that, but we do know that other states have the ability to take us right out of the negotiation because they came up with a firm proposal and we didn't have this tariff, we couldn't. That's our philosophy. Practice worked well, we believe, for our company, for customers, and for the commission and staff.
Thank you. I appreciate, Ms. White, your articulation of that. However, as I see it then, there's little or no legitimacy in the argument that it's going to be brought before the commission after the fact then, because that's entirely up to the company to decide when they're going to do it. I'll just add that as an editorial. Are there any further questions from the commissioners? Thank you. Is there anything from staff that needs to be presented at this time? If not, I will make a motion that the commission deny the tariff revisions.
Second.
Is there a second? Seeing no second, is there a further motion? Dies for lack of a second. Are there further motions?
Mr. Chairman, judging from the silence, perhaps delaying action on this item would be appropriate unless Mr. Starr has a motion.
I haven't heard any further motions, so if yours is a motion to... is there a date certain that you would like to postpone this to?
I don't have a date in mind. I suppose to keep this issue. I guess I would not make the petition because I am interested if Commissioner Starr, he admits the possibility of soliciting some additional comments, and Mr. Deacon is amenable to that. I don't want to make a motion that might preempt that, so it's something.
All right.
What I would like is, I'd ask John Smith if he sees a way to give the opportunity for additional public input from people who might not otherwise have qualified as an intervener in the case, open this up for a few weeks. In my mind, I certainly don't want to hamper any ability to go out there and do appropriate economic development. At the same time, I think this is a major policy decision, and I think it's going to affect not just Northwestern but other utilities. And I think it's important to have that input. So, Mr. Smith, could we do that through this docket with an agreement for Mr. Dietrich not to object to standing granted, or do we just open up a second proceeding and allow everyone that wants to come in and give input, with the provisos, subject to commission's approval?
Well, I think that could work. One of the issues, of course, it may be, and maybe the commission wants to think about this, although you may want to think about, I don't know, you at least might want to think about whether you want to make some interim accommodation in Northwestern. I'm not suggesting you should, but you could think about it. And that is, if you're thinking about this in the way that, like, for example, as we were, Chairman Hansen brought up the recent New York decision, that particular proceeding was in the nature of a rulemaking proceeding. They call, when they do an order, they call it an order, but it was the establishment of some general principles that would be applicable to all utilities. They had previously had guidelines related to flex rates, and within the last month they significantly revised those. And those guidelines do adopt several of the things that the utilities here are asking for. Among those guidelines are they establish a qualitative standard for measuring contribution to common costs. The other thing they do allow for then is simply the filing of agreements, and they do allow for absolute trade secret protection of all agreements filed, and I think those are some of the important things that have been expressed that I've heard. So that's one option. In this particular case, no one has actually sought to intervene. Now, is that because parties believe they would have no standing, or is it because this is sort of a case, in my view, that may have been sort of a sleeper type of thing where it's coming in and it's taking on a bigger life than I think maybe parties reading the facts filing might have perceived it to have, realistically. And if this is being transformed into a broad policy statement by the commission, I think one thing is, certainly we could get the word out to the regulated community and their competitors, represented by Ms. Rogers in the back of the room and Mr. Anderson, that we're taking this up and we're looking at it that way. The other and we'll deal with it. We'll deal with this particular case in that context. Again, though, if the commission is looking at this, if what you're really looking at here is introducing policies of general applicability to the industry. South Dakota law does require that those kind of things be done via a rulemaking. And so I don't know if that sheds any light on it or not. Problem with the rulemaking, of course, is it's very difficult to turn something like that around in a couple weeks. In fact, it's impossible.
Thank you, John. Anything further?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we postpone action on this until the next commission meeting so that the commissioners can seek legal advice from the council about how to proceed.
Thank you, and I will second that.
And I concur.
Next item up is EL05-010 in the matter of the filing by XL Energy for approval of its 2004 Economic Development Annual Report and 2005 Economic Development Plan. Today, the question is, shall the Commission approve the 2004 Economic Development Report and the 2005 Economic Development Plan? And Michelle,
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Jim Wilcox.
Hi, Jim.
XL Energy in South Dakota. In 1990, the Commission first authorized us to establish an economic development plan, and we were reauthorized in our 1992 rate case. So now this is the 15th year I've appeared before this Commission seeking approval of our annual economic development plan, where we are investing $100,000 in economic development each year in the state of South Dakota, and that's money shared, 50% shareholder money, 50% rate payer money, as approved in the rate case. We have, I think, accomplished another good economic development year, and we've filed what we did and asked for approval of last 2004 actual and in our 2005 budget, so we respectfully request approval.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. Michelle.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. I don't have a lot to add from staff's perspective. XL has a good program. They spent what they had requested last year in their 2005 budget. Is very similar to their 2004 budget, and staff would recommend approval.
Thank you. Are there any questions from commissioners? If not, I'll make a motion that the Commission shall approve the 2004 Economic Development Report and the 2005 Economic Development Plan. All right, please.
Mr. Wilcox, can you tell us a little bit about IIC? Relatively minor amounts going to some small communities in the Falls area. Do you know what those communities use, what their $1,000 goes for?
Yes, Commissioner Johnson. Yes, thank you. The filing, we try to document each one of those line items with some documentation, either a letter or a check request. We have kind of some flexibility with the smaller communities. Just try to find one for an example. The city of Emory, for example, asked for $1,000 to put up a sign to their community. I mean, that's, maybe marginally economic development, but it's something that shows the, somebody who's driving by the community what that community might have to offer. By the way of businesses or amenities. Another one, City of Marion asked for $1,000 for a swimming bathhouse renovation. These are sometimes the smaller communities are a little more of a stretch, but I guess we feel strongly that we want to support the economic development or the communities that we serve, and this is one way that I think we've been able to do that.
And I would commend XL for those efforts. I actually think that sometimes the smaller contributions, smaller communities can have a larger impact than larger dollar amounts to the larger metro area. So thank you very much.
Any further questions? If not, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I will second.
I concur.
Motion carries. On the docketed item EL05-011 in the matter of the filing by Otter Tail Corporation doing business as Otter Tail Power Company for approval of an electric service agreement for the supply of bulk interruptible power between Otter Tail Corporation, DBA, Otter Tail Power Company, and Valley Queen Cheese Factory, Incorporated. The question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the electric service agreement? Is there someone from Otter Tail to testify this morning? If not, Dave?
This is Dave Krozik from Otter Tail Power Company. I don't have any opening comments for the commission, but I am available for questions.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Chairman. this is a renewal of a contract already in place. The staff did request financial support for the rate being offered. The company supplied consistent information with the support for the last time that they filed this contract. And I would say that they have quite an in-depth system to determine what the appropriate rates are. In this particular tariff that Otter Tail has, it specifies a given margin that should be available for other ratepayers. This contract is also for interruptible power as opposed to a firm power, and as such, capacity is not an issue in this contract. The information supplied show that the rate is above cost, does meet the parameters of the tariff, and we'd recommend approval.
Thank you, Dave. Are there any questions by the commission? Is there a motion to approve? Excuse me, is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the electric service agreement.
I second.
And I will concur. On item EL05-013, in the matter of the filing for approval of an electric service agreement between Black Hills Power, Inc. and the State of South Dakota for the operations of South Dakota School of Mines and Technology and Black Hills State University, the question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the electric service agreement? And is there someone from Black Hills this morning to address this? Or, Dave, are you? Who's first up?
Kyle's on the phone if he'd care to speak to this at all.
Yes, this is Kyle White representing Black Hills Power. I also have with me Don Martinez and Brian Iverson. This is the renegotiation of an existing contract negotiation that we've had in effect in the state of South Dakota since June 1st. We are asking that the commission approve this contract negotiation with effective date May 1, 2005. Has a five-year term, does it phase in of a price increase for them to better reflect our cost of providing this service?
Thank you. Dave?
Yes, Kyle did supply supplemental information to this filing that I did distribute to the commissioners. It may precipitate some questions. However, that response by Kyle was all filed confidential. The answers provided could certainly lead to some questions by the commissioner. However, I don't know how to appropriately address those in this forum, as it was supplied confidentially.
Are there any questions by the commission that need to be answered at this time?
What is the current rate that I see with the rates we're chasing out of the 5 years? What is the current contract call for?
The current rate is 1 cent kilowatt hour delivered under this distribution billing service.
Thank you.
Any further questions by the commissioners? Dave, I don't see any of those questions at this time that need to be answered. Otherwise, we would go to an executive session.
Well, the contract is for power supplied by WAPA. The transmission is separately tariffed now under their open access transmission tariff. Through that transmission tariff, power is delivered to various substations in the area of the customers. This contract only applies to delivering or distributing the power from the substations to the customers. The contract also addresses supplemental supply, which is priced at currently tariffed rates, so there's no concern about that. Other than that, if the response by Black Hills Power and Light did not precipitate any questions by the commission, I guess we could recommend approval.
That's an educated guess. Are there any further questions by the commission? If not, is there a motion? I will move that the commission approve the electric service agreement.
Second.
Under telecommunications TC01-098, in the matter of determining prices for unbundled network elements, in the Quest Corporation statement of generally available terms, the question today, shall the commission amend the consulting contract? And who is first up on this? Harp?
I will take that. Karen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Karen Kramer. I believe Mark Stacy is on the line from QSI if you have any questions of him. To make this short, staff and Quest are at a point now where they are going to enter into some serious settlement negotiations, and we're working on that for the next couple weeks. We're trying to find a date to do that. Unfortunately, we have run out of money for our consultant, and so we are asking to amend the contract. Should this settle, we don't believe the amount will be anywhere near $20,000. However, rather than coming back for small increments, we just pick $20,000.
Thank you. Mr. Stacy, do you have any idea pertaining to the amount?
I don't know if I do, Mr. Chairman, as far as putting a fine point on it. I think that the $20,000 figure that Karen has proposed would be more than adequate. I can say that. It's kind of difficult to know beforehand where the negotiations will go and what sort of additional analysis will be required. What we do know at this point is that we intend to begin or continue our analysis by performing a state-to-state evaluation of Quest settlement offer, basically sort of doing a stare and compare sort of analysis of the Exhibit A's from each of Quest states' statement of generally available terms. That will allow us to understand where South Dakota comes out sort of in the realm of uni rates. I think it's critical to understand that because unattractive uni rates in South Dakota could very well impact the aggressiveness of CLEC either enter or maintain a presence in the market in South Dakota. Secondly, and probably more importantly than the first analysis that we'll do, is to do an analysis of wholesale-retail price relationships in consideration of the Quest settlement offer. We need to ensure that Quest uni rates don't exceed existing Quest retail rates in the state. And if such was the case, it would place CLECs in a price squeeze situation in which it would be economically impossible for the CLECs to even maintain a presence in the state. So we need to ensure that the proposed uni rates don't conflict with the ability of CLECs to stay in the market. And finally, or additionally, we'll do several different individual rate-by-rate analyses. And all of this is intended to properly equip us, or the staff, that is, and QSI to effectively negotiate with them. One other area that we'll be doing in this effort is to work with Karen and Harlan to develop, based on our analysis, an effective negotiation strategy, and, of course, the objective with that is to ensure that rates meet the public interest. Once those strategies are adopted, it will undoubtedly be necessary to perform some additional analysis. And then finally, on the agenda for us, in this case, is to participate with the staff in at least two additional negotiation sessions. First, as Karen mentioned, is tentatively, I think, scheduled for the week of the 6th of June. I'm not sure that it's been finalized yet. And then that was going to be a teleconference. Second was going to be a face-to-face negotiation session with Quest and Peer, I think. And so that kind of outlines sort of the work that is left for us to do in this proceeding, if the proceeding settles. And without like I said, I haven't really put a fine. It's hard to evaluate exactly how many hours we'll spend doing that, but like I said, I think the $20,000 proposed by Karen would be more than adequate.
Thank you, Mr. Stacey. And I understand that $20,000 comes out of the PUC budget. Is that correct? I see a nodding of the head from Heather, so accept that as a yes. Are there any further questions by the commissioners?
The original contract was in January of 2002, and it was $63,220. In January of 2003, it was increased $15,000. And now, I think at this point, the last time I checked, I think there was less than $1,000 left of that. So, okay.
Any further questions? Is there a motion? And I will second.
And I concur.
Next item is TC03-193 in the matter of the filing by RCC Minnesota Incorporated and Wireless Alliance, LLC, doing business as Unicell, for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. There is no question before the commission. It is, what is the commission's decision at this time? Rolaine, do you have anything further to add on this item?
No, I don't.
Thank you. I have a motion to read, and it's a rather lengthy motion. Do the commissioners have anything further that needs to be discussed or questions asked?
And I do not either.
And a copy of this motion has been provided to the court reporter, and there are other copies here if you wish to read along so that you don't have to type the entire motion, whatever is easiest for you. Motion for TC03-193. I move that the commission find that RCC Minnesota, Inc., known as RCC, and Wireless Alliance, LLC, known as WALLC, have met the requirements to be designated as an ETC, and that it is in the public interest to designate RCC and WALLC in the following areas. For the non-rural areas currently served by Quest, I move that RCC be designated as an ETC in the Millbank, Big Stone City, and Watertown Wire Centers. For WALLC, I move that WALLC be designated as an ETC in the T. Canton, Harrisburg, and Three Sioux Falls Wire Centers. I move that RCC and WALLC not be designated in the Huron, Iroquois, DeSmet, Lake Preston, Arlington, and Madison Wire Centers, since they would serve only a small portion of those wire centers, and the commission has previously designated as separate service areas each Quest exchange. For the rural areas where the petitioners have committed to serving the rural telephone company's entire study areas, I move that RCC be designated in the study areas of RC Communications, Roberts County, Stockholm, Strandberg, and Valley Telephone. I move that WALLC be designated in the Union Telephone study area. For the rural areas where the petitioners will not serve the entire study areas, I move that the commission reject the petitioners' request that they be designated throughout their license area, which would allow the petitioners to serve only parts of some wire centers. I move that instead the commission accept the petitioner's alternative proposal. Under that alternative proposal, the petitioners will serve entire wire centers, and to the extent small portions of some of these wire centers fall outside of the petitioner's license areas, the petitioners will serve these areas through resale or other methods. These designations will require redefining the rural company's study areas. Thus, these designations are subject to the FCC agreeing with the Commission on the redefinitions. With respect to these redefinitions, I move that the Commission not redefine each affected company's study area into individual wire centers, but instead redefine into groups of wire centers that the petitioners propose serving under their alternative proposal. For example, for James Valley, the Commission should redefine James Valley's study area by creating a service area comprised of Andover and Bristol. the remaining wire centers in James Valley study area for which RCC is not receiving ETC designation would be separate service areas. I am recommending this in order to lessen the concern that a competitive ETC could seek to withdraw from serving certain high-cost, low-density wire centers, but continue to serve less costly wire centers. I further move that the Commission not adopt the FCC's order on the Joint Board's recommendation, since that order was not released until after the hearing and the briefing had been completed. Instead, I move that the Commission impose the following conditions on these ETC designations. Number one, on or before August 1, 2005, the petitioners shall file their advertising plans and materials for South Dakota that they plan to use to inform consumers of their universal service offerings. Included in these advertising plans and materials shall be the petitioners' advertising plans and materials regarding the Lifeline and LinkUp programs, and the forms for applying for Lifeline and LinkUp in South Dakota. On or before August 1, 2005, the petitioners shall file their service agreements pursuant to which they intend to offer their universal service offerings in South Dakota. Excuse me, I should have said at the beginning of that sentence, I should have said number two. The agreements shall be consistent with the Commission's service quality rules and shall also advise customers that they may qualify for financial assistance under the federal LinkUp and Lifeline programs and provide basic information on how to apply. Number three, the petitioners agreed to disputes being resolved by the Commission. The service agreement shall state that any disputes or claims arising under the service agreement may be subject to the Commission's complaint jurisdiction at the consumer's option. Thus, the petitioner's service agreements shall not compel submission of disputes to arbitration, which would deprive customers of access to the complaint procedures of SDCL Chapter 49-13 and ARSD Chapter 2010-01. Four, the petitioners have been designated as an ETC in portions of some rural telephone company wire centers that lie outside the boundaries of the areas in which petitioners have been licensed by the FCC to provide wireless service. The petitioners shall provide service to requesting customers in such areas by extension, resale, or other arrangements with other carriers consistent with Section 214, Subsection E, Subsection 1, Subsection A. The service shall be provided at prices and upon terms and conditions that are comparable to what are provided within the petitioner's license areas. Five. Consistent with their obligations pursuant to Section 214E1, the petitioners shall continue to build out facilities and extend service to meet the statutory objective of offering service, quote, throughout the service area from which the designation is received, end quotes. Six, in conjunction with, but separate from, and in addition to their annual certification filings under 47 CFR, subsection 54313 and 54.314, the petitioners shall submit records and documentations on an annual basis detailing their progress towards meeting the statutory objective of offering service throughout the service areas for which the designation is received. At a minimum, such information shall detail the location and cost of material capital expenditures made by the petitioners within the state of South Dakota during the preceding annual period and shall include their proposed capital budgets for the state of South Dakota for the ensuing year. The petitioners shall work with commission staff to determine what constitutes material expenditures. If the petitioners and staff are unable to agree, either party shall bring the issue before the Commission for a decision. Seven, the petitioners shall annually submit proposed plans for the upcoming calendar year, which sets forth petitioners' proposed plans for construction of new facilities and service enhancements to existing facilities. The plans shall be submitted on or before March 1st of each year. Following the first filing, the petitioner's subsequent annual filings shall also include a report stating whether the proposed plans were implemented, any deviations from the previous year's proposed plans, and the reasons for any deviations. Following this annual filing, the petitioner shall meet with commission staff to discuss the proposed plans and any deviations from previous year's proposed plans. Eight. The petitioners shall construct the four additional cell sites within 1 year of their receipt of high-cost support. the year shall begin from the date of the petitioner's first began to receive high-cost support for the entirety of their designated areas. If the petitioners are unable to construct all four cell sites during this time frame, they shall submit a report detailing the reasons why they were unable to do so, and shall thereafter submit monthly reports detailing their progress toward meeting this goal. The initial report shall be due at the end of the year and time frame. 9. The petitioners shall commit to and abide by the terms of the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Associates Consumer Code for Wireless Service as it is amended from time to time. 10. By March 1st of each year, the petitioners shall provide annual reports detailing the consumer complaints that it has received during the previous one-year period. This report shall include the nature and location of the complaints. 11. By March 1st of each year, the petitioners shall provide a report itemizing the number of unfulfilled requests the petitioners received to provide service to a current customer's residence during the previous year and requests for service from potential customers within the petitioner's service areas that went unfulfilled during the previous year, including the steps the petitioners took to provide service and the reasons why such requests went unfulfilled. Following the submission of this report, the petitioners shall meet with Commission staff to discuss the report. 12. In the event that Commission staff believes that information beyond what the petitioners has provided is necessary for staff and the Commission to perform their responsibilities relating to the petitioners meeting their obligations under the law and this order, staff shall first make a request for such information to the petitioners. If the petitioners object to such request, staff and the petitioners shall first confer in an effort to resolve the issue. If after such conference, staff and petitioners are unable to reach agreement concerning the need for such information or the reasonableness of such request, staff may petition the Commission for an order modifying the conditions herein upon showing of good cause, therefore. That is the entirety of the motion.
Second.
And Rolaine did a good job of preparing it.
I was going to ask him to read it back.
Motion carries, and there are copies for anyone who would like to read it a second time. Item number 3 is TC04-225 in the matter of filing by VCI Company for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. The questions before the Commission today are, shall the Commission enter an order designating VCI Company as an ETC for its requested ETC service area? Secondly, shall the Commission provide a certification to the Federal Communications Commission and the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of Federal Universal Services report? And first up, Rolaine.
I just had a couple questions for, is Mr. Efferding on the line?
I'm here.
Thanks. This is Rolaine Waste, and I was just wondering when it appears that the purpose of your filing is that you're really targeting Lifeline and LinkUp customers. So my question is, if a customer does not qualify for Lifeline and LinkUp, would you still provide that customer service?
We do, and we offer that in the other 5 states we do business.
Okay. And then it's my understanding from the previous meeting that you are not you do not request high cost support. You're merely requesting reimbursement for Lifeline LinkUp. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So is it your understanding that you actually do not need certification to the FCC and USAC?
We do in order to provide the Lifeline eligible consumer with the waiver of the SLIC charge, which is reimbursed by USAC. That's the $6.50 to Federal Access or subscriber line charge, in addition to the Tier 2 and Tier 3 support that we can extend those discounts to the consumer, and USAC can reimburse those. So we would have to be eligible for eligibility by the state in order for them to provide us those discounts.
And it's your understanding that you actually need the certification letter in addition to designation as an ETC?
I'm not familiar with the difference. The FCC says if the state designates us ETC eligible, then we can get what's called a SPIN number from the federal program and start providing service, receive those reimbursements. I'm not familiar with the other the portion that you're mentioning.
Right, and the other states, have any of the other companies actually provided a certification letter to the FCC regarding the use of universal service support? Do you know?
I'm not certain of the difference.
Okay.
I'm not certain.
With that, I guess I would recommend that the commission approve VCI as an ETC for their requested service area, and we'll look into the certification issue to the extent they need certification, that the commission will issue that.
Usually once a dock gets ruled on and approved, then we just supply them with that information.
And that's usually sufficient?
Yes.
Because I was looking through the rules, and it seemed like the two processes were distinct. The certification was really for high-cost support as opposed to reimbursement for Lifeline Link-Up, but I just wanted to double-check with that.
Sure.
Thank you, Roland. Anything further by staff on this item? If not, is there a motion? Okay, first of all, did the court report it? Sherry, did you get that? Okay. If you could speak up just a little bit more, Dusty, on your questions, appreciate it.
I believe the motion might be that the commission would approve designating VCI as an ETC for its requested ET service area, and to the extent it's needed, it would provide certification.
Okay. So I would make that motion.
Second.
And I concur. TC05-001 in the matter of the application of Phone One Inc. for a certificate of authority to provide alternative operator services in South Dakota. Today, shall the commission grant the withdrawal? On May 4th, 2005, Phone One requested a withdrawal of their application. Is there a motion?
I'd like to speak to that before we jump into that. This company has been somewhat non-responsive. Before the agenda went out, they indicated that they would be submitting a letter to withdrawal because I threatened to ask them to, recommendation of denial for non-responsiveness. And instead of sending that letter, they actually did reply to the data request that I have outstanding. Not completely, but at this time, I would just ask that the commission defer action on this item.
Really? All right. It's interesting. How long have you been pursuing this with them?
Since January 13th.
And it sounds as if you, have you spoken with them on the phone and sent letters to them as well?
I have never spoken directly to the company. I've spoken through their consultant, and I can assure you that their consultant, who we work with quite regularly, is just as frustrated as I. Oh,
thank you. Well, then, is there a motion for deferral on this item?
Thank
second.
You. And I will concur. TC05020 in the matter of the filing by McLeod USA Telecommunication Services, Inc. for approval of revisions to its switched access tariff. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the switched access tariff revisions? First up is McLeod.
Yes, Mr. Haas is on the phone.
Good morning. This is Bill Haas from McLeod USA. I appreciate the time to speak with you about our proposed change to our access tariff. These changes are being made to our access tariff to address a couple of situations that we've encountered over the past 24 months, and actually even a little bit longer than that, back to 2001. Where certain interexchange carriers undertake self-help and either undertake self-help or do not dispute access charges and then come back at us at a point in time at which makes it very difficult for us to resolve billing disputes that they may raise, in our opinion, too late for us to have a resolution that's satisfactory to both parties. So we propose edits to our access tariff to address both situations, to discourage self-help, as well as to make sure that any inter-exchange carrier that wants to challenge our billing does so in a timely fashion.
Does staff have anything to present on this item?
When staff originally looked at this, and it was Section G that staff had a problem with and asked them to remove that language, Mr. Haas did want to present it to the commission. What Harlan tells me is that the first sentence is typical in other tariffs. I believe LECA, or I can't remember who now, he told me, has more to do with when interest kicks in. As to the second sentence, that certainly does not prohibit a customer from suing McLeod. So you can take it out or you can leave it in. I guess, you know, like I said, staff's original impression was to have taken the language out. But Mr. Haas did want to present it to you for your decision.
Thank you. Harlan, did you have anything further on this?
Not really. What I had done is what the company has filed here is a change, is to add the second sentence to paragraph 2.6.2, paren G, wherein they're adding language about if they don't do something within 90 days, the bill is deemed appropriately correct. And what other, I pulled out two different switched access tariffs, one of which was LECA. And LECA states that if the claim is filed within 90 days of the due date, interest accrues as of that date, when it was official, when it was first due. If they file after 90 days, then it's the date that they file the complaint. With as far as, I mean, that speaks to the 90 days. It doesn't speak to the second sentence at all, because I can't find any switched access tariff speaking specifically to that second sentence.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may I address the commission?
Yes, and just call me Commissioner.
This is Bill Haas. I have not checked all the other access tariffs in South Dakota. I do know, for instance, in our interconnection agreement with the Quest, there is a 9-month closure date in that agreement where we have to come to closure on billing. So there is precedent, I believe, in South Dakota, at least under our interconnection agreement, where we've got 9 months to raise an issue with Quest over our interconnection billing. No, it's not an out of the ordinary concept of telecommunications billing environment to have an end period by which time someone has to raise issues so that companies can move forward in their billings and dealings with each other. I think this has become even more of an issue for a publicly traded company, not just McLeod USA, once the adoption of the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements come out, because quarterly statements are that much more important for us to make sure that they're accurate. And if a customer can wait 2 or 3 years before they bring up a bill in dispute, it raises all sorts of financial reporting issues for a publicly traded company. So that's why we were hoping to make sure that companies that buy access services from us were properly incented to look over our bills in a timely fashion and get the issues that they see resolved quickly, as opposed to bringing things up 2 or 3 years down the line. Again, as Ms. Kramer mentioned, this does not prevent them from suing us. All it does is create, in my mind, a presumption that the billing that we sent them, that they paid for and haven't disputed, is accurate, and they would have to overcome that presumption if they were to sue us. I could not hear the entire sentence. It was kind of cutting in and out. If you could repeat it.
Yeah, no problem. Do you have any response to staff suggesting the second sentence of the current G could be removed?
Well, that's the gist. our concern is the second sentence creates what we would think is a proper presumption that if someone doesn't review and dispute our bill in 90 days, they're admitting it's accurate, so that if they sue us in court, we don't have the presumption to prove that the billing was accurate.
You don't think the first sentence does that?
Not explicitly like the second sentence does.
Thank you.
Mr. Haas, I have to piggyback on that. That's the only portion of the entire submittal that I had concern with and highlighted. And I just really don't buy the argument that a company is going to bring up two or three years down the line just if they know of a unless, of course, it's a payment that they made and they are just aren't aware of it. I don't think people are going to sit on a significant refundable deposit of some sort or a situation where they've made overpayment and ignore that. Do you have...
Yes, unfortunately, Your Honor, or Commissioner, we do. It's actually publicly disclosed in our 10-Q where we have a couple of inter-exchange companies that have challenged us going back at least 2 or 3 years for access charges that they paid us, and after an FCC ruling last spring decided that they shouldn't have paid us. And one of their arguments has been, oh, we never actually intended for you to send us the traffic. And in our case, we're talking millions of dollars in disputes over those charges for traffic that, in our opinion, they knew they were getting and paid for, but after an FCC ruling came out, they said, well, we didn't actually mean to pay for that. Well, in fact, this has occurred.
So the FCC ruling was that it was their money.
The FCC ruling was that in order for a CLEC to charge for that type of service, you had to explicitly mention certain language, arguably in the tariff, in the position of the inter-exchange carriers.
Thank you. John, did you have some?
I did, I guess. In terms of most of the disputes we've seen involving this kind of situation stem from the accuracy of the minute records and the calling party's identity, et cetera. Could you please comment on that and with respect to you? Let me ask you one other specific question is, do your billings in this regard rely upon Quest's record-keeping system?
No. Not in all instances. We rely on access charges. We certainly rely on other companies' call detail records, the information we get with each call. So if we don't get all the information we need, it makes it difficult for us to bill it accurately. But that's not unique to Quest, my knowledge.
Well, that's all we have here in South Dakota. I just wondered, because most of the disputes we've had have not involved situations such as the FCC case you raised, but they've involved a high level of uncertainty involving the accuracy of minute data and calling party identity data. And maybe you can comment on this. I mean, one issue I guess I have is, you know, given that, I think what we've seen is that until companies have the opportunity, which sometimes takes months, it sometimes does occur months later, to do a full, in the Quest system, cards, record-keeping audit, et cetera, they have no idea whether the invoices you've submitted are accurate or not. And again, your invoices in this state are probably not that huge, but I mean, that just seems to be what the disputes here have involved. And so I guess the concern I have is just that this provision may not jive with business reality. Can you comment on that?
Yes. I'm not familiar how complaint that you may have seen in your state. I do believe on the access side of our industry that companies, given the amount of expenses and revenues involved, companies tend to pay closer attention to access billings and perhaps some other billings because of the large sums of money involved for individual companies. And I don't think it's unreasonable for carriers to expect other carriers to promptly review access billings because they do represent such a large revenue stream for a lot of companies. And I think that's my response. This is an important area. I know most telecom companies that I'm aware of have more than a couple of individuals dedicated to reviewing access charges and access invoices.
Thank you.
Any further questions by the commission? Anything further from staff on this item? Not. Is there a motion? I will then move that the commission approve the switch to access tariff revisions except for 2.6.2, second sentence in subsection G, which reads, payment by customer of an invoice without timely initiating a billing dispute shall be deemed an admission by customer that it used the access services provided the rates charged were valid and the billing was correct.
Second.
Yes, you do. I mean, you have to approve it, so if you elect not to approve this particular change, you have that authority.
I'm curious if we have the ability to do that, or if the commission could only approve or deny, but it's in our power, I'll certainly concur.
Motion carries. Item 6, TC05-055, in the matter of the filing by Quest Corporation for approval of revisions to its access service tariff. Question before the commission is, shall a commission approve the tariff revisions?
I'll start with this. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Colleen, do you have any comments?
No, we would just ask the commission to approve this. There were no interveners, and there are no rates that are changed. We would just ask the commission to approve it.
Thank you. Harlan?
What Quest is doing in this docket is standardizing language across the 14 states. Staff would recommend approval of the modifications.
Thank you. Anything further from staff? Is there a motion?
Chairman,
I will second.
And I concur.
Motion carries. TC05-056 in the matter of the petition of DIECA Communications Incorporation, doing business as COVAD Communications Company, for arbitration of an interconnection agreement with Quest Corporation. Question is, how shall the commission proceed?
I will start with this one. For this one, I believe that the parties would agree that this presents just a legal issue. In other arbitrations, what the commission has done is that we have held hearings, sometimes lengthy hearings, but in this case, I believe the matter could be handled with a briefing schedule, and I believe the parties have a briefing schedule to propose.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I'm Dave Gertis from PEER, and I'm appearing, or I should say our office represents COVAD, but I do have the permission of the Quest attorney to present to the commission a proposed briefing schedule of initial briefs served by June 10th, simultaneous initial briefs by June 10th and simultaneous responsive briefs by July 1st, after which we would ask that the commission provide a time for hearing to for the parties to argue their sides. And then as far as a deadline for a decision date, we would leave that up to the commission.
Did Quest have anything?
No, I concur. This is Melissa Thompson. I concur with Mr. Gurnis' comments.
I did not realize you were on the line.
Oh, that's okay.
And my question was if either of the parties had decided what the deadline was. I know it's common practice and you come up with a beginning date and then we count forward, but if my calculations were correct, it was somewhere toward the middle to end of July. And if that calculation is correct, then I don't believe that your dates do work. And what I would suggest is that the dates actually be moved up a week. The dates don't work with respect to having an opportunity for our oral argument and then having the commission decided at the next commission meeting. Does anybody have any? I'll give you the dates that I came up with, and you guys can respond. But I would have June 3rd as the first briefs, June 24th as the second, oral arguments at the commission meeting June 28th with the decision on July 12th at the commission meeting. Any comments on that? Unless I'm wrong with as to when the actual decision is out, but I count them back through the 9 months. And
I'll rely on your arithmetic, Rolaine, and I would say that the parties would not object to that.
Quest?
I'm just looking at my calendar really quickly here. I don't see a problem. I think those dates work for us as well.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there a motion? I will move that the commission proceed via the time frame that was set out by staff for a briefing June 3rd, second briefing June 24th, time for hearing June 28th, decision date July 12th.
Second.
Correct. Thank you. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be May 24th. Commission meeting scheduled for June 14 and 28. PUC office will be closed May 30th. In observance of Memorial Day, we all wish Maxwell the very best, and please give him a hug for us. And meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.